Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today Judge Dustin Howell from the 200th Judicial District Court of Travis County, Texas. Welcome to the podcast, Judge Howell.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I've listened to a bunch of podcasts, but I've never been on one, so this is exciting.
Well, we're glad you're here, and we appreciate it that you listen to us some, too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always fun to have someone on who's got some familiarity with what we're doing, and you go even beyond that, because we're going to get into what you've done in your career before you took the bench, and you definitely got a perspective that's relevant to appellate practice that I look forward to hearing about. So, just so the listeners get to know you a little bit, I mentioned that you're on the 200 Judicial District Court bench here in Travis County. Let's talk a little about your background, you know, where you come from and sort of your early career.
Yeah, so I grew up in Wichita Falls, which is in far north Texas, right on the Oklahoma border. I came down to UT Austin for undergrad, where I majored in Spanish. And when I enrolled at UT, my plan was to be a high school Spanish teacher, but I got more interested in business when I was there. And after I graduated, I went and worked at Dell. So I worked at Dell for 5 years before I went to law school in sales roles primarily. And so I started out in the consumer segment and then moved over to the higher education market. And my last job at Dell, my wife and I moved to Atlanta, and my territory was the Southeast US, where I set up programs for college students to buy Dell laptops through their colleges at a discount. And so the SEC basically was my territory for Dell. And it was when we were living in Atlanta that my wife decided to go to law school. And we were at a coffee shop and she was studying and I was just reading a book. And I started flipping through her LSAT study book and said, you know what, I bet I can beat you at this test. And so she said, well, sign up for it then. And I did. And so I took the LSAT the same day she did, really with no intent at that time necessarily to go to law school. I just wanted to win, and I did. Well, I won by 2 points, which is within the statistical deviation, but a W is a W. So I knew I would eventually, my plan career-wise was to get an MBA at some point. But when my wife decided to go to law school, I thought, well, I'll go to law school when you do, and I'll get a JD, and then I'll just go back into business after that. And so we ended up going to Texas Tech for law school together. And it was out there where I kind of fell into a more traditional legal career path.
You got indoctrinated, it sounds like, out at Tech. Is that certainly your path? I did not know either that you were a Spanish major or that you had spent all that time working at Dell. So that's quite interesting. If someone ever needed a bilingual computer salesman, maybe you were the guy.
Well, I would not be the guy, because I always clarify in every job interview I've ever had, they see, oh, BA in Spanish, you must be bilingual. And I always have to clarify, I have a BA in Spanish, but I do not speak Spanish fluently. You know, I never studied abroad, I've never been immersed in it, so I can kind of get through it, but I do not consider myself fluent. So I like to joke that my resume should have an asterisk, BA in Spanish, does not speak Spanish. And just get that out of the way.
Oh, that's great. Well, but so after Texas Tech then, you went on to a judicial clerkship at the Texas Supreme Court, if I recall correctly.
That's right. So I clerked for Wallace Jefferson, who was Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court at the time, and had a wonderful, wonderful experience there. Learned a ton. That was really where the seeds of my interest in becoming a judge were planted. And so I worked for Chief Justice Jefferson for a year, and that was the 08-09 term, which coincided with the economic downturn, which resulted in my, from there, went to the Austin office of Baker Botts, but my start date was delayed, as was happening in a lot of big firms. And so I had an extra 3 months at the end of my clerkship where I wasn't going to be doing anything. And As it turned out, Justice Green's secretary or executive assistant had retired right at the end of that term. And I think she was planning on coming back, but there was going to be the 3-month lag. And so I ended up moving down the hall and being Justice Green's executive assistant for 3 months. So basically it was a third law clerk for him and got to extend my clerkship time. So it was a real treat to do that.
It's a really unique experience that probably no one has ever done before at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was, you know, for law clerk turned executive assistant. It was, although my co-clerks in Justice Green's chambers had no idea how bad I was as an executive assistant until I was replaced. But they're okay. I don't feel too bad for them.
You know, for a guy that basically fell into the law through a competition with his wife, you were off to a pretty strong start there, I would say. Clerking at the Supreme Court, moving on eventually to Baker Botts. How was your practice at Baker Botts? Were you able to do appellate work there? Backing up a step further, did you catch the appellate bug while you were clerking at the Supreme Court?
Certainly initially, you know, because I was immersed in it for a year, 15 months, and got to continue to do appellate work at Baker Botts. So my docket, I was there for about 2.5-3 years. My docket was pretty much evenly split between federal district court litigation, and that was primarily in the Stanford International Bank receivership, which was being litigated in the Northern District of Texas in Dallas. So half of my work was coming from that case. And then the other half was appellate work, working primarily with retired Chief Justice Tom Phillips there in the Austin office. And so, you know, that time certainly confirmed my interest in appellate law. And what an amazing mentor and friend Tom Phillips is and was to me then and still is now. And that was, again, you know, to go from working with Chief Justice Jefferson to Chief Justice Phillips, I'm just so lucky to have had that opportunity. And it was amazing.
Yeah, you've had some really, really great mentors.
I'd say so. Well, you were at Baker Botts for about 3 years. And I know at some point you went on to the Solicitor General's office. Was that the next step?
It was. So I went there. I went from Baker Botts to OSG. In my time as a law clerk at the Texas Supreme Court, had seen a fair amount of the work from the SG's office and knew just how high level, high quality their work was. And while I was at Baker Botts, I kind of decided that I wanted to specialize in appellate law. I'd always, to kind of go back to, you know, your observation about my change from not being interested in being a lawyer to being very much into being a lawyer. What I found was that skill set that I had, that I felt like I always had, was I always enjoyed research and writing. It was never anything that was really tapped into at Dell. That's where, you know, when I got into law school, I realized, oh, I have the skill set and it actually suits me pretty well in this career. And appellate law in particular is well suited for that. And so once I kind of decided this is where I want to specialize, is in the more appellate level of practice, I knew that if I had the opportunity to go over to the SG's office, I would take it. And as it worked out, around the time I went over there, was they had expanded the office a couple of spots. And so I put in for one of those openings and was fortunate enough to get that.
Well, and that's an excellent training ground for a young appellate lawyer. And those spots are very highly coveted because they do some extremely important work. You know, for those who don't know, that's essentially the appellate law firm for the state as part of the Attorney General's office. And every time you see a case up in the U.S. Supreme Court or in the Fifth Circuit or Texas Supreme Court or even the lower courts where the state's a party, you know, they're quite often the SG's office has taken over those cases. Not always, but I've always admired the office and the fact that it offered younger and sometimes not so young appellate lawyers or lawyers who wanted to be appellate lawyers a great opportunity to really learn what it was all about and work on cases at just an extremely high level.
Yeah, I learned so much working there. I was there almost 4 years and worked on some very interesting cases. And as you said, Todd, I kind of described it as the appellate boutique within the Attorney General's office. But yeah, all of the practice in the U.S. Supreme Court was done by the OSG. But even when appellate matters were not handled by our lawyers, we were in consultation with the divisions of the AG. But yeah, you know, primarily I got to pick my own cases. And so, you know, my goal was to get as much experience as I could in the time that I was there. And so I handled cases where I argued in the Texas Supreme Court, in the Intermediate Courts of Appeals, State Courts of Appeals, had several Fifth Circuit arguments, And so it was a phenomenal learning experience. And it was one lawyer to one case primarily, but we worked really well as a team without the pressures of, gosh, am I billing too much? Can I go, is this person, you know, assigned to this matter? Can I, if I go and spend an hour in his or her office bending their ear about this issue, am I eating into their billable time? It was very collaborative. And every brief we filed had to be read and reviewed by two of your colleagues. Every argument that we had, you had to moot it twice before a panel of three colleagues. And so every case was done right. And it was just, I don't know, I loved it.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
That's one of the things that you do miss out on in private practice is the cost-benefit decisions that have to be made so often on those things. And it's so great that you are able to do that in every case because it does make such a difference to be able to have people freely give you input, not worried about the time constraints, the billing constraints, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it was such a collegial office too. We all got along really well. We all would go to lunch every Friday together at the Dog and Duck Pub. May it rest in peace.
Dog and Duck.
Which is actually now the location of the new Travis County Courthouse is on that same block. But yeah, I loved my time there. I handled really interesting cases and just had a ton of fun doing it.
But you had some more private practice experience before you went on to become a judge. That was at Will Smith here in Austin, right?
That's right. So I had been at OSG for almost 4 years. I had just come off of my massive defeat in the Patel eyebrow threading case. My legacy of my time there, which by the way, was a really fun, interesting case to work on. Argued, by the way, in the Hill County Courthouse, the Texas Supreme Court, you know, most appellate practitioners in the state know, kind of they do roadshow arguments where they hear arguments outside of Austin. And this one was in the old Hill County Courthouse in Hillsboro, Texas. And so the eyebrow threading case was a challenge to the constitutionality of the state's regulation of eyebrow threading, which is a means of plucking eyebrows. And the state required a license. And I was there arguing on behalf of the licensing requirement. And the threaders, represented by a group called the Institute for Justice, was challenging the constitutionality of that regulation. And the state had prevailed in the trial court, prevailed in the Court of Appeals. It goes to the Texas Supreme Court. And it's in this beautiful old courtroom with the gallery and the second floor. And I mean, it looks straight out of To Kill a Mockingbird. But, you know, a trial bench is a one-judge bench. And you've got nine justices there to hear an argument. And so the way they set it up was they just had a couple of long tables in the well of the courtroom right in front of the bench, with a music stand right in front for the lawyers to stand at and put their binders on. And so I get there for the argument and I'm kind of thinking about, gosh, what is it? How is this going to work? And I get up there and it's so bizarre because I'm looking down on the justices, which is an unusual setting for an attorney. Not to mention there was also no skirting around the table. And so the first thing I hone in on is Justice Willett's socks. But, you know, they start asking questions, all that goes away. But I'd had that case. I just finished that. And I got reached out to by an alumnus, an OSG alum who was at McCool Smith, and they were wanting to build their appellate section and asked, would I be interested in joining them? And I said, my wife and I think we're just about to have our third child. And so financial reasons, I decided to jump over and go back into private practice where I had a great experience. You know, McCool is while I was there as an appellate lawyer, it is a very trial intensive firm. And so I got a lot of really good trial experience while I was there.
Did you do more of the appellate side of the litigation, you know, kind of help them preserve error, charge, that kind of stuff? Or did you do some of the trial work as well?
Primarily appellate-y trial work, right? So I was the law guy, handled all the briefing that we were in the couple of big cases I worked on. I was primarily the one writing the briefs. And then the couple of cases I was in that went to trial when I was there, I was at trial every day or most of the days and either writing the bench briefs or working on the charge and consulting on the various legal issues that would come up along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great work. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. That's some of the kinds of work that to me really make this practice fun because you're not, yes, it's writing intensive, but you're not locked behind the desk constantly at the computer. And of course, we're all chained to our computers these days because of COVID and the status of jury trials in our state and all over the country. But what a great way for you to segue, take that, all that very wonderful sort of ivory tower appellate experience gained at the SG's office and then take it back out into the trenches, into the trial courts.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so I was part of a team that went to a jury trial in Marshall, Texas, in the Eastern District out there, and seeing the presentation, seeing the jury arguments, and you really do get a sense when you're there in person of the fluidity of arguments and how they evolve, how organic the whole thing is when you're there live in real time. It's very different from, like you said, you know, when I was at OSG and everything was sort of delivered to me in reporter's record. Mm-hmm. It looks a lot more dry than it is when you're right there in real life and seeing witnesses being cross-examined and seeing the expressions on the jurors' faces as they see some of that unfold.
Wow. Do I remember correctly, too, though, you did a lot for a young lawyer with those various moves, but you were pretty involved in PYLA, as I recall.
That's right. Yeah. So I've been involved with, well, I'm no longer a young lawyer by definition, but since I was in law school, I was actually the law student liaison to the state bar when I was at Texas Tech, and eventually through that became the law student liaison to the Texas Young Lawyers Board at the time that Judge Karen Crump was president of that board. She's now a colleague of mine here in Travis County. But yeah, so I kind of got the bug, the bar bug then, and was, so I got involved with Austin Young Lawyers when I moved back to Austin as a lawyer and eventually ended up on that board and then ran for the Texas Young Lawyers Board to be the rep from Austin and served on that board and eventually was elevated to be chair of that board. And so in my last year of eligibility, I'm now, you know, a Texas old lawyer, I guess, but
as a oh, Texas. Thanks.
but yeah, so I was chair of that board, which was a really cool experience because I was involved in all of our projects that we did all over the state focused on all kinds of really important matters geared not just towards lawyers, but the community, right? I mean, the Texas Young Lawyers is billed as the public service arm of the state bar, and they take that responsibility very seriously. And so we were out there generating new content and projects to present to students and teachers and veterans and you name it. We were out there and it was so much fun. I loved going and speaking to groups of students about the projects we were working on and teaching them about our democracy and or the civil rights movement. So that was a really, really fun and neat experience.
Well, and so you went on and became a trial judge. Tell us the story about how this young appellate lawyer, still at that time certainly eligible for TYLA, manages to ascend to the trial bench.
Well, I left OSG maybe 2 years prior and had been at McCool and was enjoying my experience, but I just felt the tug to get back into private practice, I guess. I mean, into public service. And as I had said sort of at the outset, once I had clerked for Chief Justice Jefferson, I knew that if I ever had the opportunity to become a judge, I wanted to go for that. And whether it was on a trial bench or an appellate bench, I mean, I would love to serve on an appellate court one day, but a lot of the appellate judges that I admire spent time, a significant time on district court benches too. And so the way it kind of panned out for me was people I knew from the SG's office had followed then Attorney General Abbott to Governor Abbott's office to work in his general counsel's office. And so I stayed in touch with those people because they were just friends of mine. And talking to a couple of them, you know, expressed my interest in becoming a judge and just asked, you know, hey, I don't know the first thing about this process, but now that y'all are over there and you've been involved in appointments, I mean, do I have enough tenure as a lawyer? Would I be considered for it? And they said, yeah, you know, put in an application. And if something comes up, then you may have a shot. And so I put in an application blindly. There was no opening in Travis County at the time, but it was in the springtime and the legislature was in session. And that particular session, the ledge created the 459th District Court of Travis County, which created a vacancy out of nowhere. And so not long after that bill was signed into law, I got a call asking if I was interested in interviewing, which I did. And thankfully, the governor appointed me to that opening. And I was grateful for that opportunity to serve. And as it turned out, it was a one-year vacancy, and I fully expected that I was going to probably return to private practice after that. But as it turned out, at the towards the end of that term, one of my colleagues, Gisela Triana, won election to the Court of Appeals, and she had 2 years left on her term as a trial judge. And so the governor appointed me to fill that vacancy. So now I'm at the tail end of that term. So what was one became 3 years. And so that's how I got my spot.
How was the transition? You know, you had done public service at the Supreme Court. You'd kind of done it again at the SG's office, but you'd also been back in private practice. How was it going back to the court side of things?
I loved it. It's been a very different area of the law than what I had previously done as an appellate lawyer. It's so fast-paced, especially, I mean, we're not doing jury trials right now, but, or at least not in the courthouse, but the pace of trials was unlike anything on the bench side of things, was unlike anything I had experienced before. And the volume of work that comes through the courthouse was also a big change. You know, as an appellate lawyer, I had sort of my handful of cases that I was responsible for at any given time. As a trial judge, man, I mean, every day I'm having hearings and either I'm ruling on them from the bench or more often taking them under advisement because perhaps of my appellate background, I'm not comfortable ruling on something until I've really dug into the case law and gotten comfortable with it. And so it was a change for sure, but fun. I've loved it.
I don't really practice in Travis County trial courts a lot, but you kind of do the rotating pretrial docket system, don't you?
Yeah, we call it a central docket, and which basically means that any given case can be heard by any given judge. And so if you've got your case is Smith versus Jones and you've got a motion for summary judgment and the case is nominally assigned to the 53rd District Court, but you decide you want to have a hearing on your MSJ, you've set it on the docket. And it used to be you found out the day of your hearing who was going to your motion. Now we're making, with the Zoom scheduling, it requires a little more advance notice. And so you find out on the Friday, the week before, who's going to hear your motion.
When do you, as the judge, get access to the papers for that type of thing?
Well, the same time the lawyers do. And so today I'll find out, because we're taping this on a Friday, I'll find out what I'm hearing next week sometime today.
Okay.
But when we were making those announcements the day of, on motion weeks, on non-jury weeks, we had settings at 9 and 2. And I found out at 8:30 and 1:30 what I was hearing.
Wow.
Which is just enough time to just skim the briefs before you go. It's a challenge, and it's not how I would have preferred to do it, but I've seen it work. And I am a believer in the central docket. It is efficient, and it ensures that people get settings. So I think it works really well. And for the more deliberative types like me, I make it work. I take things under advisement, and I never have felt like it's really held me back.
That's really the trade-off you just mentioned for the folks that don't practice here. San Antonio has a similar system, and you don't know most of the time when you're going into a hearing who your judge is going to be. And some people really don't like that. But the benefit is, as you suggest, Judge, you can get your cases set. You can get a jury setting. If you have an MSJ, you're going to be able to get it set not too far off of the 21-day minimum, generally. And it really does add a lot of predictability scheduling-wise to things. You just have to adjust to your judge in most instances is not going to know anything about your case if you walk in, and certainly if you're appearing the first time before them on that case. But it changes the strategy a little bit, because in ordinary cases, one of the tasks of the trial lawyer or whoever's arguing a summary judgment motion is going to be to educate the judge. And that education that you go through at any given hearing doesn't carry through to the next one, because unless you happen to draw that judge at random again, you may never appear before the same judge.
Right. But, you know, I think it's a good practice to educate the judge, whether that judge is assigned to your case or not. I mean, confession time, even in the cases that are assigned. I mean, we do have, you know, it's an exception to the rule, but we do have cases assigned to us. I still need that reorientation, right? Because of the massive volume, it's very transactional. All of the motions that we handle, it's just, I can't possibly remember all the nitty gritty. I need that refresher, even in cases that I have heard before. And all it takes is a little bit, But I think it's a good exercise to walk through the background and kind of, I tell people, explain this case to me the same way you would explain it to your mom or some non-lawyer, right? Give it to me at that level and then let's get deeper, right? But let's start at a high level because I think people are so involved in the case. And I heard Judge Costa's interview that you posted recently, and I think he had sort of a similar opinion that it's very easy when you're involved in a case and you just live it to just jump right into the details. But for the judge who is hearing the motion, a little context is needed and background and tell that story, right? Same way you would do it in an appellate brief. I think there are a lot of skills that appellate lawyers have that can translate very well to trial, to motion practice, at least in the trial court. And I wish I saw more of it, frankly.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as court surety bond agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
That was actually one of the things we wanted to talk to you about. I mean, what kind of stuff do you think appellate lawyers can do on their own or, you know, in assisting trial counsel to really make the most effective motion practice in a district court?
I think there is a misconception, at least in Travis County, and I would think that there is probably a similar sense about briefing generally in state trial courts, that briefing isn't as important. And I think that is completely wrong. Briefs are so important because they are the guide to the judge. If a matter like a motion for summary judgment, some sort of legal issue that's going to be taken under advisement, your brief is your voice to that judge and his or her staff after your hearing, right? And it is the guide to the decision that that judge has to make. It's the same in the trial court as it is in an appellate court. But I think, at least in Travis County, where we had the central docket and everybody knew, you know, the judges don't get a chance to study the briefs before they come out and have the hearing, that briefs just don't really matter that much. But I think if anything, they're more important, right? Because I'm going into a hearing, I don't know a whole lot about the case. I've had a chance to maybe skim the briefs before I come out. But if I take it under advisement, then that brief becomes very important because that is my resource that I'm going to start from to get oriented to the case. And so, you know, trial lawyers would benefit from appellate counsel or appellate-minded counsel in preparing briefs that really act as a guide to the trial judge, just the same way as they would an appellate judge.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've been telling lawyers around Travis County that the written work product is really crucial for just that reason. That, and especially, I think, for someone, when you've got a judge like you that we know to be very deliberative and who's going to actually read the cases and study the issue and try to get it right. I know there's a lot of pressure to move cases, but you also want to get it right. And because you don't want to, if the third court is going to check your papers, you know, you'd like to hold on to the ruling that you got. And so getting it right the first time is important. I think it's incredibly short-sighted for a lawyer just to go into a court in Travis County and rely on their oral argument to the judge to make their case, especially when it's a legal issue.
Yeah, I see it a lot, right? I mean, I see motions that if they don't have a requirement to be responded to, a lot of lawyers just don't respond to them. So a discovery dispute, for example, motion to compel, I go in and now that I find out on Friday what I'm going to hear the next week, I do have the time to read the briefs before the hearings. And so I do. And I'll look and I'll see a motion, but no response. And I just think to myself, why on earth would you pass on that opportunity to advocate not only before the hearing, but potentially after if the judge takes it under advisement? You brought up a point, Todd, when you were sort of the transition from trial to vice versa. You know, I am a judge who likes to read the cases and dig in. And in terms of not wanting to be reversed, as I like to put it, whether as a matter of vanity or judicial economy, I don't want to get reversed. And what it comes down to is I want to do the right thing. And so I do dig into the cases to try and make the right decision. And because I don't want to make an error in the law that results in people having to incur additional expenses to come back, especially on a remand after a trial, have to come try a case because I made a wrong call. So right. That's always in the back of my mind. And I'm always thinking about what's the Court of Appeals going to make of this decision or that decision.
That's a great perspective, and one that I feel like sometimes it feels as the attorney, sometimes that gets overlooked. It really is the cost to the client, because you want to get the law right and the client wants to get a result, and a lot of times the law right, but you do have to think about what it costs to go through that process. And I appreciate that you keep that in the back of your mind.
To no one's surprise, I mean, your approach to this is very methodical and appellate lawyery. And so what I wanted to ask is, absolutely, you know, I get where you're coming from 100% when it comes to getting it right on the law, but have you found it difficult dealing with discretionary decisions on the trial bench? Because, I mean, we all know that's a tough standard of review. When you get up on appeal, you're most often you're going to be affirmed no matter which way you go, as long as the record backs you up. But how's it been for you approaching those kinds of issues?
Yeah, I mean, you don't always have clear guidance from the case law that gives you a clear up and down on something. And thankfully, there is abuse of discretion review on a lot of the decisions that we make. And so it kind of depends on what's in front of me. I'll tell you one thing, that one concept I was not super comfortable with as a new judge, and it was something that they preached at new judges school. It was the idea of rule and run, which was the exact opposite of my instinct, which is they would say, especially in trial, all these evidentiary objections that come up, you can't get too bogged down in them because ultimately you just have to move on, right? You got to make decisions and move on. And very early in my trial judge career, I would want to really dig into the intricacies of every hearsay exception and exception to the exception. And I still do that some, probably more than others, but I do have to sometimes just make a decision and move on. And sometimes I'll have counsel who wants to insist on arguing even after I've made a decision in that realm where it's abuse of discretion review. I mean, a lot of the times I just have to say, look, counsel, I've made my decision. You've got your point is preserved if you want to raise this on appeal, but we've got to move on. And that's not legal mindset that came naturally to me, but it's something I've had to adopt out of necessity.
It is nice as an appellate lawyer that you do have kind of the lens of thinking about, is it preserved? Have you let them make their objection and put it in the record and kind of keeping a good, clean record going for whoever wants to take it up on appeal, assuming that they do?
I try to. You know, I don't want to stand in the way of somebody preserving their error. And so when people want to put on for a proof or, you know, the various other things we have to do to preserve error, I get it. So I'm never annoyed when counsel asks to do the whatever it is that has to be done. One of the areas that I think we as appellate lawyers get lectures on every time we go to an appellate conference is charge error and how to preserve that properly. And that is a very, you know, intricate dance. As far as I've seen in the couple of dozen jury trials that I've had, I don't know that I've seen it preserved properly more than once or twice. So then you're sort of falling on the mercy of the Court of Appeals to say, well, you know, there's enough here that we're going to go ahead and let you raise this point. But boy, that's one where, for whatever reason, trial lawyers just don't have that figured out yet. All the more reason to have appellate counsel involved, right?
Well, we try not to make it easy. We try and use the most complicated rules and standards that we can so that they don't figure it out. They've got to keep ourselves employed, you know?
Right.
That's right. That's right. Well, that actually, yeah, that's a point that we've preached a number of times here on the show is, you know, that's jury charges. It's just not a phase of the case where you want to mess around with error preservation. Because you just don't know if the Court of Appeals is going to do what you said, which is say it was good enough. So I've always seen that as a great entry point. If you haven't had appellate counsel already on the case, you know, if nothing else, focus on your closing argument and let someone else handle the jury charge for you, especially if there's any issue foreseeable involving error preservation, because, you know, you may win, but you may not, you know, ultimately if it goes up on appeal and there's something in there that wasn't objected to, it could be really dangerous. And you wind up having a big judicial economy problem because jury charge error most of the time is going to wind up with a reversal and a remand and retrying the case.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, charge work always ends up being more than the lawyers expect it to be. Mm-hmm. It is a time-consuming task that nobody, I think most lawyers don't appreciate how much has to go into it. And, you know, understandably so, right? You've got experts you're trying to cross and parties you're trying to put on. And there's so many decisions and big matters to be dealt with in a very short amount of time at trial. But it's been my experience that lawyers tend to underestimate the amount of time that needs to go into getting the charge ready and tend to put it off just out of triage. But it's always the front of my mind at the beginning of a trial, and certainly my staff attorneys, who is typically the one shepherding through those revisions over the course of the trial. And so in terms of trial judge advice, I would say don't underestimate the level of effort that has to go into having a charge ready.
Totally agree. And so often, I know I've seen, and I bet Todd it's the same, that if I'm on one side as the appellate lawyer helping with the charge, like every once in a while, you'll have someone who will have an appellate lawyer show up the day of the charge conference, and then they'll hand them the charge and go make the objections. And that's a disservice to both the appellate counsel and the trial counsel, because how am I going to know? You can hand me what you want to hand me, and I'll make whatever objections I can make, but there's no way I'm going to be able to competently go through everything and see the issues if you just kind of hand me, here's the charge, go up there and tell them what you need to tell them.
Make a bunch of no evidence objections.
Yeah, it's about all you can do. Maybe a Castile objection here or there.
You know, the informal charge, I come out and we chat about, here's what I'm thinking, you know, should go in question one and this and that. But that none of that's on the record. And when we start the formal charge conference, it is me saying, okay, this is the formal charge conference. Counsel, do you have anything to say? And I'm not going to guide you through it. I expect the lawyers to know how to say what they need to say. And there's very little participation from me in that process, and other than just making my rulings. So it's something you need to know how to do to get it right.
Have you tried any cases over Zoom? I know everybody's gone to Zoom now. I'm sure you've had plenty of hearings, but have you done any trials?
Bench trials, yes. I have not done any jury trials. This week was supposed to be our first jury week on Zoom in Travis County District Courts. And I don't know, I didn't have one assigned to me. I think there were one or two that were teed up that for whatever reason didn't go. And I am told that our next jury week, which will be a week from Monday, that we've got, I think, three on standby ready to go. And so we'll just see if they go or not.
You're not assigned to either one of those or any of the, you say, potentially three at this point, or do you know?
I don't know. I don't think so. But, you know, that actually, you know, or at least back in pre-COVID times, I found out on Monday, the same time the lawyers did, what case I was going to try.
Yeah, it's not just regular hearings, it's trials too. You know, everything. You didn't know who your judge was going to be until you showed up. I mean, I've been following what's been going on in Travis County with the possibility of remote jury trials. And I know that the district judges have been working really hard to try and figure out a way for cases to go forward. And so I believe that the way that that's been structured is the judges are actually teaming up, you know, as far as voir dire versus actually getting into presiding over the trial. And there's just so many adjustments procedurally that have to be made to try a case. And we're talking about over Zoom as opposed to, you know, some kind of hybrid model, at least right now. But some of the groups I participate in have been really, you know, trying to educate not only lawyers, but the public about how these things can go forward. And so there's some really neat technological initiatives, like OCA is agreed to provide cellular-enabled iPads to each of the potential jurors. And so I know there's been a lot of thought that's gone into how these can proceed. So I certainly look forward to seeing how that turns out. We've been slow to get out of the gate, even though we're faster than most, I think. We're ahead of the game as compared to a lot of counties. But it's just been difficult to get the process started because so few lawyers actually wanted to be the test case. Right, that's what's going to go forward.
That's the key, right? I'm really proud of the work that's gone into getting us ready. And Judge Crump actually who chairs our jury committee, has been a leader in the creative thinking and collaborating with OCA and the other judges about how we can do this over Zoom. But at least here in Travis County, we have not reached a point where we're going to say, your trial date is November 1st, and you're going on Zoom whether you want to or not. The rules, as I understand it, the current emergency order from the Texas Supreme Court authorizes counties to do that, but we've chosen to make it voluntary, and we are ready to go. It's just a matter of whether the cases that are teed up actually do decide to go. I don't know that there's been broad uptake on it just yet, but it may just take a few of these to go and go smoothly for people to be more comfortable with it. We have, so in addition to the normal kind of everyday civil cases that we try, personal injury and commercial cases, another part of our jury docket for the civil district judges in Travis County is the CPS docket. And so while we, other than Judge Byrne, and the rest of the district judges don't really handle the CPS cases pre-trial, we do handle the trials of those cases. And those cases are subject to statutory deadlines. And so I think it is more likely that we will try those just because they have to be tried. And I don't know if in terms of what's scheduled when, but I think it's likely that those will be some of the first to go.
This is separate and apart from any criminal cases. I mean, your court, the civil district judges only hear civil cases. And so we actually have a separate criminal courthouse for the criminal district judges and county court judges. And they're dealing with these issues, you know, all on their own and have their own statutory limitations, you know, Speedy Trial Act and so forth to deal with. But that's been my impression that probably the cases that are going to pave the way, and this is not limited to Travis County, I wouldn't think, are going to be those that address their CPS matters with those kinds of built-in statutory deadlines. And so, you know, we're going to learn a lot, I think, because those cases are actually going to be proceeding sooner rather than later and probably in a virtual form. So I look forward to seeing. I know they're, with that setting coming up this month, I think we're actually going to start seeing it. Even the CPS cases sometimes get resolved, you know, on the courthouse steps, as it were. But I think we're going to start seeing it sooner rather than later. And the lawyers practicing in other parts of the civil bar need to sit up and take note, because I know that Travis County is not imposing virtual jury trials at this point, but you can see the day coming that that might actually happen. It's not a comment about Travis County specifically. It's just a comment on what I hear from OCA, which is every day that goes by that we're not trying jury trials, we're going further in the hole with the numbers are just astounding. I mean, David Slayton has reported that there was 5,500 jury trials that were supposed to go over a 6-month period, and there were 45 cases tried statewide during that period. So you can see the trend. I mean, we've got to find a way to start clearing this out, because it's just going to be an incredible, incredible backlog.
Well, I think the work that's been put in on the front end allows us, we are in a position to try cases and we are ready to go. I understand why lawyers might be hesitant to do so, but for any of those who are out there who are thinking that we're ready to have you, for sure.
Well, what would you say, knowing what you know now, I mean, you've been on the bench for 3 years or so at this point, what would you say some of the lessons that you've learned over that time that you would like to impart to either trial lawyers coming before you, or our audience specific is, you know, more likely to be interested in appellate issues?
Yeah, I mean, I talked before about what I think is underappreciated importance of briefing in trial courts, and also the importance of really giving context to your arguments and telling a story, right? Making sure that you create that framework for the judge so that you're educating them on, and I tell lawyers, like, look, I rely on you to educate me on this, and that should be your role, is to inform, not just argue. And I think when you're in the heat of battle, it's easy to just see the other side as the bad guy and I'm the good guy. And judge, you need to understand why they're wrong and I'm right. And that's one way to approach the problem, which is you're asking the judge to solve. Or I think the more effective approach is to just explain rather than argue. It's subtle, I guess, in its difference. But I think that lawyers who do a good job of that and just giving a story that can be understood by someone who's unfamiliar with the case, that those matters are huge. I'll also say, and this is something that we hear as lawyers throughout our career, but it doesn't seem to sink in, is casting aspersions on the other side, trying to say that the other side is being dishonest. It's rarely effective. I mean, not enough to justify doing it. I can't tell you how often I see lawyers just saying the other side is misrepresenting things or being dishonest, and then the other side gets a chance to respond. And it's like, okay, there actually is a reasoned difference here, right? And that sort of thing, it just leaves a bad taste in my mouth and usually makes the accuser look worse than the accused, in my experience. So just try to be positive, I guess. And, you know, and it's easy for me to say, I guess, as the judge who's kind of the neutral in the whole thing and not as dug in. But, you know, I also experienced this as an appellate lawyer brought on to trial matters, and the trial lawyer would call me and say, hey, you know, we need you to handle this motion. You can't trust a word this guy says, and da da da. And sure enough, you look through the deposition transcripts from the case, and they're sniping back and forth. And then I get on the phone with him and like, oh, he seems like a nice enough guy. But it's easy to get caught up, I guess, in the adversarial nature of our business. But when it comes time to present a case to a judge, I think it's way more effective to just focus on the legal issues and be positive. And that's just too kumbaya or positive. That's how I prefer it.
I don't think that's too kumbaya at all. It'd make all our lives a lot easier if more people would follow that approach. And, you know, we've kind of seen a trend, I think, over the last 6 months or so of even more snarkiness in briefs and pleadings that we might have seen otherwise, just because folks were expressing frustration, sometimes inappropriately.
If anything, this should be a time where we're showing everyone more grace than perhaps we would, but it's a tough time for everybody. But I find it to be more effective when people are positive in their presentations.
I know that you are not seeking re-election to your bench. What are your plans for the future when your term is up?
Well, this is being recorded in October and so of 2020. They're actually at the end of the last legislative session, the legislature created yet another civil district court for Travis County, the 455th District Court. And so now that sits vacant and would be up for election in 2022. And so I've indicated my interest in that appointment to the governor's office, and fingers crossed they'll consider me for that. And I might get a couple more years on the bench. If not, I'll go back into private practice and we'll see what is in store from there. I don't know. If it's back into practice, I'll have to think about what I want that practice to look like, right? Because I've only worked in big firms and in the SG's office. And sitting here right now, I'm not exactly sure what I would want my private practice to look like now that I've had this time on the bench, because I want to make the most of the lessons I've learned. And the experience that I've gained in this time could translate to good counsel to other lawyers and to parties. But how that translates into a practice, I think it would just, there's a lot of variables that I'll have to kind of sort through and determine exactly how I'd want to build a practice after this.
That experience, I mean, look at your resume and I think, wow, big firm, SG's office, you know, another great litigation firm now on the trial bench. I mean, you've got really an incredible amount of experience that it'd be great for you to continue on as a trial judge. But if there's another opportunity that comes your way, I would just think that you would bring a lot to the table. So we sure enjoyed visiting with you today, Judge.
Absolutely.
I always like to hear trial judges' perspectives, but you know, when you're one of the fold, it's even better. And of course, we like it when trial judges come on and say how important appellate lawyers are, because we certainly want the trial bar to be reminded of that from time to time.
Well, you certainly are. And don't let anybody tell you you're not important.
We agree.
But yeah, no, this has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed your show and I've loved being a trial judge, and getting to see it from the perspective I had coming into it it's just been a thrill a minute. I'll tell you though, my favorite part of the job is the jury trials, and it's what I miss the most. Mm-hmm. The drama and the energy level is so high in those jury trials. And to get to see that aspect of our civil justice system playing out right in front of you, it's just such a treat. And to be a participant and with the best seat in the house is just, it's been, I don't know, just a real blessing. And getting to interact with the jurors afterwards and get their impressions. And I'll tell you this, I guess I'll leave you with this, is that I have complete unqualified faith in our jury system. Sort of one of the things that affirmed that for me was, in the first few trials, I'm hyper-focused on what the lawyers are doing, what they're saying, when they're objecting, this and that. And what I found is when I go back and talk to the jurors after a trial, they're focused on the witnesses. They're focused on the evidence. And so when I ask them, what made the biggest impression on you? They're talking about, well, this expert kind of got into this analysis and this expert said that. And that was kind of, we really had a tough time. And when you look at the whiteboard in the jury room after a trial, and they have just filled it with notes, and the lawyers are secondary, tertiary to their observations of what was important about the trial. That's exactly what it's supposed to be, right? And I guess mm-hmm. I shouldn't have been surprised by that. But the fact of the matter is, juries are smart and they get the work done. They see through the noise and they always ask, Judge, do you agree with us? And the answer is, your decision is the right decision. We asked you to make this very difficult decision. For the parties, it's the most important, for a lot of them, one of the most important, it's a life moment for them. some of the matters that we're asking a jury to decide for them. It's a lot of work. It's emotionally draining for jurors, but they get in there and they do it. They do the work. And I'm just so proud of the jurors. And it's so neat to be involved in that process.
It's always great to hear that and to hear those reassurances from the people that are on the front lines and get to see it up close and personal in a way that we never do, because sometimes you'll get to talk to the jurors afterwards, but you just never get the same, I think, level of candidness that you get to see from your side of the bench.
There is a level of candor that they have with me after that trial when they're just so relieved to be done. But the other thing too is my office is right down the hall from the jury room, and you hear the rise and fall of emotion as they're deliberating, right? And so you hear them all laughing, or you'll hear somebody talking loud and then another person kind of talking across the table. And it's a real thing, right? How this body of 12 people reaches a decision is, I don't know, it's neat to kind of have that perspective as a judge.
Thank you again. We have really been glad to have you here today. And before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Corporate Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texaplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram @texaplawpod, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texaplawpod.com or on Twitter @texaplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own, and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.